Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is now in force. What does this mean for the future of nuclear armaments? And first, we examine the role and the duties of the U.S. Attorney General. For whom does and should the Attorney General work? And what's behind the growing control of the Department of Justice by the presidency? Doug Becker explores these questions.
I'm Doug Becker. Merrick Garland has just been confirmed as President Joseph Biden's Attorney General. This office and the Department of Justice has been a focal point of controversy in previous years. In particular, the tenures of President Donald Trump's Attorneys General, Jeff Sessions and William Barr, have raised critical issues on the proper relationship between the Department of Justice and the presidency. On today's show, we will examine this relationship, the expectation and necessity of independence out of the office, and how this relationship will likely proceed in light of the developments of these recent years. Our guest is Cornell Clayton. He is the C.O. Johnson Distinguished Professor of Government and Director of the Thomas S. Foley Institute for Public Policy and Public Service at Washington State University. He's the author of The Politics of Justice, Attorney General, and the Making of Government Legal Policy. Thank you very much, Professor Clayton, for joining us. My first question is a deceptively simple one. Who does the Attorney General work for?
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the invitation to be with you today. So that's a very, it's a tough question to answer. I guess the easy answer is the Attorney General works for the American people. Of course, the real question I think you're asking gets at questions about separation of powers. And should we think of the Attorney General primarily as an executive branch officer in the same way we think of as other executive branch cabinet members and their obligations to the president? Or should we think of the Attorney General as more autonomous from direct presidential control, maybe having special obligations to the courts or to Congress? And the answer to that question, I think, has changed over time. The way the framers of the Constitution and the framers of the Judiciary Act of 1789, which created the Attorney General's office, I think thought about the role of the Attorney General very differently than we do today. And that's a long story. It's a long history about how that the position has evolved over time.
I know there's been quite a bit of an emphasis in recent years, and in particular with President Trump and the question of independence of the Attorney General and who exactly does he or she work for. But this question certainly predates the presidency of Donald Trump. What have been some of the issues that have been raised recently that called into question some of the independence of the Attorney General prior to the 2016 election?
Oh, prior to the Trump administration? Mm-hmm. Well, clearly, you know, under the George W. Bush's administration, for instance, there was a lot of criticism of the Justice Department's role in the war on terror, especially some of the opinions that came out of the OLC's office and some of the litigation positions taken by the Solicitor General that seemed to stretch the law as it was at the time and took positions that was contrary to established principles of law. You know, if you go back further, there was a lot of criticism during the Reagan administration of what Attorney General Meese did, changing a lot of the litigating positions of the Department of Justice and adopting a very aggressive stance towards constitutional interpretation. Prior to that, of course, the Nixon administration was very controversial, I think for different reasons. Most of them having to do with whether or not the Justice Department was going to be a watchdog over the president who was acting corruptly. And you can go back. I mean, in the Eisenhower administration, there was problems with corruption in the Department of Justice. In the Harding administration, problems with Teapot Dome scandal involved the Attorney General. So these controversies have been off and on throughout the history of the office, but in particular in the 20th century. And I think one of the things to understand is why the Department of Justice and the Attorney General have become more controversial on a more regular basis in recent decades is as a result of a number of broader institutional developments. And one of those is simply, the growth of the administrative state and the role that the Department of Justice has in, because it's the chief litigator for the federal government, it controls the litigating positions of all federal agencies. So it has a chokehold on regulatory decision-making in lots of ways. Also because increasingly we have begun to, our courts have become much more important policymakers over the last, half century. And so operating right at the nexus between the executive branch and the courts, the Attorney General and the Department of Justice are now critical policymaking roles. And so that's why they've become increasingly more controversial in terms of their policymaking roles, in addition to these questions about corruption, which is a more perennial problem that you see with respect to the Attorney General and the Justice Department.
Now that question of corruption, there seems to be an endemic tension here then, because since the Attorney General is nominated by the president can presumably fire the Attorney General as a member of his or her cabinet. The expectation that the Attorney General could investigate other areas of the executive branch, doesn't that create an inherent conflict of interest? And so is it most proper that the Attorney General as a member of the executive be the watchdog over another executive, or is that a role that probably should be played, more, for instance, by the legislative branch, by a congressional oversight of the executive?
This is a problem, again, it's been a perennial problem. It came to a head in the aftermath of Watergate and Nixon's resignation, and the politicization of the Department of Justice took place then. There was a set of hearings. Sam Irvine headed up the hearings back then about what to do about this controversy and the controversy more generally about what is the appropriate role that the president has in directing the general policies of the Department of Justice. So again, I want to separate out these two questions. One is this more narrow question of corruption and prosecution of corruption within the administration and who should do that. And the second question is, what's the general relationship between the administration's policies and the Department of Justice policies? And the Irvine committees took on both those questions. In the end, they decided and they considered legislation that would have made the Attorney General and the Department of Justice an independent agency. They would have, much like heads of independent agencies like the FTC or the SEC, they would have made the Attorney General appointed to a fixed term of office, not removable by the president, thus buffering him from political control, and all the authorities of the Attorney General, which means the entire Department of Justice. They rejected that reform, but in the end, in 1978, they adopted a more narrow reform in the Ethics in Government Act, and that created the so-called Independent Counsel's Office, which operated up until 1999, by the way. The Independent Counsel's Office got at that more narrow problem of what happens when you have credible evidence of misconduct by people high up in the administration and who can prosecute them in a credible way, free from conflict of interest. And the Independent Counsel statute aimed at getting at that precise issue. In a case called Morrison versus Olson in 1988, the Supreme Court upheld that office against the constitutional challenge that you couldn't remove prosecution from direct presidential control. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Chief Justice Rehnquist at the time, a strong advocate of executive branch power, nevertheless said that the independent counsel statute was constitutional because it was very narrowly tailored and it got at this question of conflict of interest. And that the key question was not whether the prosecution is an executive function, thus should be controlled by the president, but rather the key question was whether you could remove that very narrow function from direct presidential control and not impede the president's constitutional duties and obligations. And the court said you could, so they upheld the independent counsel statute. Now, of course, that doesn't mean it was good policy, and because independent counsels tended to take on their own life once they were appointed. We had that whole fiasco with Ken Starr and the investigation of Monica Lewinsky. It came, it went on forever. there was a bipartisan agreement that the independent counsel mechanism wasn't working well. So they that was the act was not reauthorized in 1999. And so the independent counsel mechanism went away. It was replaced by a different reform called the special counsel provisions. There are simply policies within the Department of Justice that try to provide some independence to special counsels, but they are still under the direct control of the Attorney General.
Now, I know in a piece that you had written that critiqued, at the time, Attorney General Barr, you had cited some of Barr's comments about the lack of independence of the Attorney General and the designation of the Attorney General's office as really being under the president's purvey. And you referenced something called unitary executive theory. First of all, what is unitary executive theory and how popular is it when considering this question of the independence of the Attorney General?
Yeah, the unitary executive theory is an idea that it's actually not it's not that old. It's been around for several decades now. It has been propounded primarily by conservative legal scholars and Justice Department officials, but sometimes you also see it in Democratic administrations as well being argued. The argument is that because the Constitution vests all executive power in the president, that any function, any duty, any power that we categorize as executive must be under the direct control of the president. And that you can't have any kind of autonomy or independence from presidential control if you're performing executive functions. And so that's the unitary executive branch theory. Again, I think it's been rejected by the Supreme Court on numerous occasions. With respect to the Department of Justice in particular, it was rejected in U.S. versus Nixon, and also in Morrison versus Olson, the case I just talked about. You know, one of the interesting things in U.S. versus Nixon, you know, we think about that case primarily because the court for the first time recognized the constitutional idea of executive privilege. And that's how we normally think of U.S. v. Nixon. But there was a jurisdictional threshold question in that case, which is very important. The attorneys for Richard Nixon argued that the case should be dismissed by the court. In fact, argued it couldn't even be heard by the courts because the special prosecutor in that case, Leon Jaworski, was a member of the executive branch. And as a member of the executive branch, the case was essentially an interbranch conflict. It was essentially President of the United States versus President of the United States, and the courts can't intervene in an interbranch conflict. That was their jurisdictional argument. The Supreme Court rejected that argument and said basically that Congress can, under statute, create some autonomy, some independence from presidential control of executive branch functions. And to the extent they've vested that authority in the Attorney General, and the Attorney General then created some independence for the independent counsel, or the special prosecutor in that case, then the president couldn't object to being sued by an executive branch official. So this idea of executive, this unitary executive theory has been rejected in recent years by the Supreme Court. But if you went back, I think, to the founding period or the early period in the Republic, that the whole idea would have been anathema, I think, to the founders. I think they broadly saw the executive power as a power of management and enforcement of laws created by Congress, and that Congress had a tremendous amount of authority to control how laws would be enforced. And the president's duties were to carry out what Congress was directing the president to do, so long as those commands were constitutional. But, the powers of the executive branch have grown enormously, especially in the 20th century. And so that's a whole different story about the growth of presidential power via the Congress we could talk about later.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the independence of the Attorney General's Office in the Department of Justice with Cornell Clayton of Washington State University. He is the author of The Politics of Justice, Attorney Generals, and the Making of Government Legal Policy. Thank you. Now, Professor Clayton, you had highlighted examples of this tension, this relationship between an independent attorney general and the presidency. I noted that each of those examples, Harding, Eisenhower, Nixon, Bush, and then certainly Donald Trump, are all Republicans. And so is this tension more salient with Republican administrations? Or put differently, is this really a partisan question where the question about the independence of the Department of Justice is really much more of an issue when we have Republican presidents than Democratic presidents?
No, there's certainly been corruption scandals under Democratic presidents. There was a lot of criticism of Eric Holder, for instance, in the Obama administration for being too solicitous to the president's power that Obama was exercising. There have been criticisms of Bobby Kennedy was appointed by Robert Kennedy. That was seen as a tremendous violation of the norms governing the Department of Justice. He was seen as somebody who was unqualified, and not only there was questions about nepotism there, and him being too solicitous to President Kennedy. So that this is not necessarily a partisan issue. I do think that in recent decades, Republican justice departments and attorneys general get in more. They are more controversial because they are more likely to accept this unitary theory of executive power. And therefore, these administrations appoint attorneys general who have a different view about their relationship to the president in general. And Barr laid that out perfectly in many of his comments. In one of his more controversial speeches, he basically said, look, I work for the president. That's my job. And anybody who says otherwise, it's nonsense, because everything I do is an executive function and the president directs everything I do. And I think increasingly Republicans, because they accept this unitary theory of the executive, they appoint attorneys general and Justice Department officials who have that view of their relationship to the White House. And they behave that way. On the other hand, I think Democrats are less likely to think that's the role the Department of Justice should be playing with respect to the White House. They are more likely to appoint people who have a sense of independence and autonomy, that there's some obligation to the courts, the Congress, in addition to the executive branch. And I think Merrick Garland exemplifies that perfectly. I mean, one of the things that happened in the wake of Watergate was not just these statutory reforms, legal efforts to safeguard the Department of Justice, but there's this whole effort to create new norms. And one of the norms, Jimmy Carter pledged, for instance, to appoint somebody who would be apolitical, with an apolitical background, to the Department of Justice. And of course he did it. He appointed Griffin Bell, who was a former federal judge. Gerald Ford likewise appointed Edward Levy, who had been a law professor, a law dean, the president of Chicago Law School for 30 years, was seen as an apolitical character, not someone who had been involved in partisanship and partisan administrations in the past. And I think you see that again now with Merrick Garland, for instance, this idea of you should seek somebody who has a judicial background, who sees their role as a little more autonomous than other members of the executive branch from direct presidential control. Republicans, I think, are less likely to think about the attorney general in those terms. And so I think that's the difference.
Now, we've laid out kind of the historical trends and try to put this relationship in this historical context. In doing so, to ask the question that I think first and foremost on my mind, was the Trump administration's Department of Justice unique, perhaps more egregious, in this expectation of a lack of independence from the Justice Department, or being much more acquiescent to the president's wishes than previous administrations? Is it fair to say that Jeff Sessions and William Barr were both unique, perhaps less independent than previous attorneys general?
I mean, there have been other attorney generals who have felt very close to the president. You know, Edward Meese certainly felt that way to Ronald Reagan, for instance. There's no question. I think that John Mitchell felt that way to Richard Nixon. Bobby Kennedy felt that way to his brother, right? So I think there is a difference with the Trump administration. And again, I want to, from my perspective, a lot of this has to do with much broader institutional trends taking place. There are two separate sets of institutional developments that came together, particularly in the Trump administration, that I think are problematic for the Department of Justice. One is this one I've already talked about, and this is the idea of accumulation of power in the executive branch, which has been going on since at least the 1930s. The executive branch, the presidency is becoming more and more powerful vis-a-vis Congress. And so that's one development that's taking place. There's another development that's more recent, and that is the growing autonomy of the president from party control and congressional control. So in the modern administrative state, when that started to develop, progressives overcame the problem of this very powerful administrative regulatory bureaucracy by putting under presidential control. But the assumption was presidents could be controlled by Congress through the party mechanism. Parties could pick presidents, could discipline presidents. And essentially, that's exactly what you had with Richard Nixon. The reason Richard Nixon had to leave office is because his own party, his own congressional party, came to him and said, your time is up. The problem is, since at least the 1990s, as a result of changes in the way we fund our campaigns, particularly, is presidents have become increasingly autonomous from party control, meaning increasingly autonomous from congressional control. Congress can't stand up to the president. The congressional party can't stand up to the president any longer. And so what you're getting is two separate trends coming together. One is the growing power of the presidency on the one hand. The other is the growing personalization of that power on the other. And you saw that with respect to Donald Trump. He thought not only was the Justice Department an instrument of the executive branch, he thought it was an instrument of him personally. And I think that's what may, and Barr, I think, acceded to that view in many ways. And I think if there's anything that's unique or different about the Trump administrations and their way of thinking about the Justice Department, it's that.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the independence of the Attorney General's Office in the Department of Justice with Cornell Clayton of Washington State University. And certainly the fact that the Attorney General Sessions lost his job in part because of Trump's anger that he was not intervening in the Mueller investigation, fits that narrative.
Protecting him personally, yeah.
Exactly. But when Barr was asked to intervene on behalf of the president with respect to the election, Barr kind of drew a line in the sand and seemed to say, this only goes so far. Is it fair to say that that's, that is that interpretation? I mean, do you share that interpretation? Does that show that perhaps there is a limit to how much the president can try to use the attorney general to serve his, very specific interests?
I mean, I think in the end, Barr said, I'm only willing to go so far. Now, keep in mind, this is against the backdrop of what he did with the Mueller investigation, for instance, and, which was basically dramatically to protect Donald Trump. It's against the background of what he did with respect to, prosecutions against Michael Flynn and against Roger Stone. So he went a long ways towards using his power to protect Donald Trump personally, as well as the Trump administration's policies. I think in the end, who knows what he had in his mind. I think he saw what Donald Trump was trying to do with the election was simply illegal. And so he was not willing to go that far, and he had his one foot out the door anyway. So does he get credit in the end? Yeah, I think he does. But again, I do think it's, I hate to put too much emphasis on these specific individuals who are in these offices. And I think it's much more important to put them in the historical context. The growing power of the presidency on the one hand, and the growing personalization of that power and independence that presidents have from their congressional parties. That's huge, I think, in understanding what happened with Trump.
Now, so last question, though, is since there clearly was a limit as to how much the president can use this office for his own personal gain, plus conversations like the one we're having here, do you see that this a potential backlash against this growing presidential power over the Department of Justice and calls for more of an independence? Do you think the trend is going to go towards even further co-optation of the Department of Justice for the president's interests? Or do you think there's a sense that President Trump exposed the challenge of an unchecked presidency when the Department of Justice can't check it, and that there's a need to rein in the presidency?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unclear what's going to happen in the future. I do think that the Biden administration are trying to reestablish norms of professional independence and autonomy at the Department of Justice. They've picked the perfect person to do that, Merrick Garland. But, you know, again, that's exactly what both Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter tried to do by appointing, you know, autonomous individuals to the head of the Department of Justice back then. And then as soon as you get a president who doesn't have that view, those norms get quickly reversed. That's the problem. Unless you have an effort to take on frontally this idea of the unitary executive theory and institute in law some kinds of protections for the Department of Justice, you know, norms are just norms and norms can change. And there's tremendous pressure, you know, again, I don't see how we're going to dramatically roll back executive branch power. And I don't see right now that we are going to change the way we elect officials in campaign finance reform. And so those two competing, those two pressures, you know, the growing power of the executive branch and the personalization of that power in the president himself and autonomy from Congress, those are going to be a problem in future presidents. And so the Department of Justice will be vulnerable to that kind of politicization again, if you want to put it in those terms, unless you have some kind of legal statutory reforms.
So we've been discussing the relationship between the Department of Justice and the presidency, questions of just how independent is or should the Department of Justice be, and the potential trends in addressing those questions. And we've been discussing this with our guest, Cornell Clayton, who is the C.O. Johnson Distinguished Professor of Government and the director of the Thomas S. Foley Institute for Public Policy and Public Service at Washington State University. He is the author of The Politics of Justice, Attorney Generals, and the Making of Government Legal Policy. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When we come back, what exactly does the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons mean for disarmament and the future of nuclear weapons? Stay with us. Listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, now in force, was meant to lead to the total elimination of nuclear weapons. Might the removal of the nuclear threat to the planet be in our future? Doug Becker explores.
Welcome back to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. On January the 22nd, 2021, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or the TPNW, entered into force. Hopefully for signature in 2017, the 50 ratifications required for the treaty to enter force were secured in roughly 3 years. This treaty's stated purpose of a nuclear weapons-free world has faced opposition from the precise states it is meant to address, those countries with nuclear weapons stockpiles. In this segment, we will review the treaty and discuss the next steps in nuclear disarmament. Our guest is Ira Helfand, He is the co-chair of the Physicians for Social Responsibility's Nuclear Weapons Abolition Committee and also serves as the co-president of PSR's Global Federation, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. He's also a member of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN's International Steering Committee. In honor of its work on this treaty, ICANN was recognized with the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Halfand is also the co-author of PSR's reports, Nuclear Famine, 2 Billion at Risk, which outlines the global health consequences of regional nuclear war. Dr. Halfand, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Doug. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you. And so let's start with, what exactly is the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and how does it differ from some previous existing treaties dealing with issues of nuclear proliferation and nuclear armaments?
Well, the TPNW is meant to close a gap in international law. Up until the entry into force of this treaty, there were treaties in place that prohibited the possession of chemical weapons, prohibited the possession of biological weapons, that banned cluster munitions and banned landmines. But the worst weapons of all, nuclear weapons, were not banned in international law. And that's what the TPNW does. It creates an international norm saying that these weapons are basically so inhumane, so intolerable, that not just the use of the weapons, but the simple possession of the weapons is now defined as being illegal under international law.
And what's striking is that previously, nuclear weapons were allowed to be created, to be developed, and to be deployed, or you know, at least maintained by a certain number of nuclear weapons states under the so-called Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. How important is it that we're sort of, the way you describe this is addressing this gap in international law, but to close that gap to ensure that the countries that have nuclear weapons no longer are legally allowed to possess them?
Well, you know, the Non-Proliferation Treaty made an explicit exemption and said it was okay for five countries, the United States, Soviet Union, then Russia, Britain, France, and China, to have nuclear arsenals. It essentially blessed their arsenals. It did tell them that they were supposed to negotiate in good faith to ultimately eliminate them, but they haven't done that in the 50 years since the treaty went into effect. And they maintain that they're still within their legal right to have these weapons under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. What happened, I think, is that after literally decades of being told that they needed to honor their obligations and not develop nuclear weapons, the non-nuclear armed states finally said, enough. We have held up our part of the bargain. It's time for you to honor your part of the bargain, and you are supposed to be getting rid of your arsenals, and you're not. So this treaty was designed very much as a way for the non-nuclear armed states to come together to stigmatize the possession of nuclear weapons and to put pressure on the nuclear armed states to honor their obligations and to get rid of these weapons. None of the nuclear armed states were involved in the negotiation of the treaty. They actively opposed it and have shown varying degrees of hostility towards it, including the United States under both President Trump and before him, President Obama. The Obama administration worked very hard to block unsuccessfully the adoption of this treaty. But that is the challenge that we face. How do we use this treaty to move the position of the nuclear armed states? And, you know, there is some hope, I believe, that here in the United States, the Biden administration will be much more open to the idea that it should welcome this treaty as an important step towards the elimination of nuclear weapons, and that perhaps we can get this administration to take the steps that the U.S. needs to take in order to move rapidly towards the realization of that goal, the elimination of nuclear weapons.
Now, when thinking of nuclear weapons, one of the most striking aspects of this is if they're grouped together as President George H.W. Bush had grouped together what he called weapons of mass destruction, which would include biological weapons and chemical weapons, that biological weapons have a convention that bans their construction, stockpiling, as well as use, as well as, you know, chemical weapons, you know, in the same way. But nuclear weapons were treated differently. Do you have some thoughts about why it is that we've treated nuclear weapons differently than chemical and biological weapons, in particular considering the fact that of the three, nuclear weapons are far more destructive.
Well, I think the problem is that the great powers really wanted to have nuclear weapons. They were willing to give up chemical weapons, which they didn't think were that important to their military planning, and they were willing to give up biological weapons, but they all base their military planning on the possession and potential use of nuclear weapons. That reality really needs to, we need to grasp that. I mean, these weapons do not exist just, you know, to deter somebody else from using them. All of the nuclear armed states have explicit plans for how they would use nuclear weapons under various circumstances. And as long as these weapons exist, and as long as these doctrines exist, there is the real possibility they're going to be used. So I think that's also the reason why there's such strong resistance from the nuclear armed states. We are telling them they need to completely change their thinking about national security. But of course, they should change their thinking because their thinking is profoundly wrong. They have made a gamble that possessing nuclear weapons will make them safe. All the evidence suggests that nuclear weapons are in fact the greatest threat to the national security of the United States and every other nuclear armed state. There's really nothing else that threatens the United States in a military sort of way that we cannot deal with our conventional forces. But none of our forces protect us against nuclear war. We may have the strongest nuclear arsenal in the world, but that doesn't keep another country potentially from launching nuclear weapons at us and causing unimaginable destruction.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons with Ira Helfand of ICANN. We're not terribly far beyond the threats in 2017 that highlighted, you know, threat of a nuclear exchange between the US and North Korea. And so certainly when considering what are the sort of the areas of the greatest concern about nuclear proliferation, North Korea and Iran are both on that list. In your estimation, would a ratification of the TPNW give the U.S. a stronger foothold or stronger foundation to counter North Korea's nuclear proliferation, Iran's proliferation, than currently the system under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty does?
I'm not sure that the U.S. simply ratifying the treaty would solve these problems. It would certainly put us in a much stronger moral position to confront Iran and North Korea. But I think the problem goes beyond that. It's not just for the U.S. to ratify the treaty. The U.S. needs to sit down with all of the other eight nuclear armed nations and conduct the detailed negotiations for a verifiable, enforceable, time-bound agreement to dismantle the remaining weapons. The TPNW does not include those sorts of specifics. And that was a deliberate decision, that negotiating the timetable and negotiating the verification regime and the enforcement regime would needlessly delay adoption of the treaty, and that those negotiations wouldn't be meaningful without the participation of the countries that actually had the weapons. But that's the next step that has to take place right now. And the U.S., the role that the U.S. can and should play is to initiate those negotiations. This is not going to be an easy task. The North Koreans feel strongly that nuclear weapons are the only thing that keeps their regime alive. The U.S. is going to have to figure out with the other nuclear armed states how to change that, how to convince the North Koreans that other security arrangements, as distasteful as that would be for us, are possible, and that they don't need to have nuclear weapons in order to feel that their regime will survive. This process has to be based on the security needs of all of the nuclear armed states. But the critical piece of this whole puzzle is for the leaders of the armed states to understand, as Gorbachev and Reagan did in the 1980s, that whatever security concerns they have, whatever issues divide them from their potential adversaries, none of that is worth the risk of a nuclear war. And that is the bottom line truth here. We are risking nuclear war every day that these arsenals exist. We have come perilously close to nuclear war on many occasions, within minutes, literally. And it is not because we have had sound military doctrine or wise leaders or infallible technology that we are here today. We're here today because we've been unbelievably lucky. And the current nuclear policy of all the nuclear armed states is at a very profound level, nothing more than a hope for continued good luck, that somehow or other we'll muddle through and we won't stumble into a conflict where these weapons are used, that there won't be an accident where the weapons use of these weapons is triggered, that there won't be a terrorist attack that leads to a nuclear war. There's no particular reason to think that our luck is going to hold indefinitely. And experts like former Secretary of Defense William Perry, the board of experts at the Board of the Atomic Scientists, are all telling us we're closer to nuclear war than we've ever been, closer than we were in the worst moments of the Cold War. And given that assessment, it is imperative that the current leadership of the United States move dramatically and energetically and creatively to try to bring the other nuclear armed states into an agreement. And we don't know this will succeed, but we also don't know that this effort will fail. Nobody would have predicted in 1981 that Ronald Reagan was going to sit down with the Secretary General of the Communist Party and declare together that nuclear war can never be won and must never be fought, and sign the first of a series of enormously important arms reduction agreements. There's no reason to think that if Joe Biden sits down with Putin and with President Xi, he cannot have the same kind of breakthrough that Gorbachev and Reagan had.
Now, one of the criticisms against, you know, moving towards what typically referred to as a zero option, the elimination of all nuclear weapons, is what happens if one of the parties maintains even a small nuclear stockpile, the so-called bomb in the basement scenario, and the need to have nuclear weapons as a means to try to deter whether it's another state or even a terrorist organization that might seize control of a nuclear weapon, that we need these weapons in order to defend ourselves against such an attack.
What's your thoughts? Defend us. If somebody chooses to attack us, they're going to attack us. Right now, there are something like, 5 to 10,000 nuclear warheads, probably closer to 5,000 nuclear warheads aimed at the United States. Does that make us safer than if there's a couple of bombs in a basement someplace? I don't think so. The problem of someone cheating on the agreement is real, and we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to it, but I think it's a boogeyman. The real problem isn't the possible danger that someone's going to have a bomb in the basement. The real problem is that there are, in the world right now, 13,000 nuclear warheads that are available to be used in the event that things spiral out of control somehow. And there's a real danger that that's going to happen. And the data generated by the scientific community over the last decade shows that even a very limited use of these weapons, as few as 150, 200 of these weapons, will cause, if they're used against urban targets, will cause profound climate disruption across the entire world because of the smoke put into the atmosphere by the fires these bombs would cause. This would in turn have catastrophic effects on global food production and trigger a worldwide famine that could put billions of people at risk. This is the danger we're living with. This is what we should be worried about, not a bomb in the basement. And I think we need to sort of get real about this. What is the real danger that we're facing?
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Our guest is Ira Helfand. He is the co-chair of the Physicians for Social Responsibility's Nuclear Weapons Abolition Committee, and also serves as the co-president of PSR's Global Federation, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. He's also a member of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN's, International Steering Committee. In honor of its work on this treaty, ICANN was recognized with the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Helfand is also the co-author of PSR's reports, Nuclear Famine, 2 Billion at Risk, which outlines the global health consequences of regional nuclear war. So, a lot of the focus has been on the nuclear weapons states' opposition action, ranging from ignoring the treaty to outright hostility. What can Americans concerned with this issue do to try to address and you know, potentially change American policy, which I think it's fair to say at this point is, you know, has been fairly hostile to the treaty, to change the American attitudes and convince President Biden to sign the treaty?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we need to change is the whole U.S. view of the role of nuclear weapons in the world. Currently, U.S. security policy is based on the idea, which I think is profoundly false, that nuclear weapons make us safer and that we need to have nuclear weapons forever, essentially, to secure our safety going into the future. We need to create in this country an understanding that nuclear weapons are not guarantors of our safety. They're in fact the greatest threat to our safety and security. And people need to understand both the likelihood that we will have a nuclear war if we don't get rid of these weapons, and the full extent of the consequences if we do have such a war. Here in the United States, we have launched a campaign called Back from the Brink, the call to prevent nuclear war, which is an attempt to create that understanding and to build a national consensus for a fundamental change in U.S. nuclear policy away from this false doctrine of deterrence to a real understanding that our security demands the elimination of all nuclear weapons everywhere. And the campaign's central platform is a call on the United States government to begin the negotiations that we were talking about with the other nuclear armed states for a verifiable, enforceable, time-bound agreement to dismantle the remaining weapons. This campaign has been endorsed now by over 350 organizations around the country, by more than 50 cities and towns, by six state legislative bodies. And we are trying to build the kind of pressure needed to get the attention of the new administration and to get them to understand that the nuclear problem can't get put on the back burner. They're dealing with a lot of other huge problems: COVID, the climate crisis, the current economic crisis. They cannot ignore nuclear weapons despite these other issues that they have to deal with. They have to view the danger of nuclear war as a crisis situation that requires urgent attention. And they also have to understand that the only real way to deal with this problem is ultimately, and when I say ultimately, I don't mean in the distant future, I mean in the near term, getting rid of these weapons. And Back from the Brink calls on the administration to begin these negotiations. It also calls on the United States to adopt a number of interim steps unilaterally to lessen the danger of nuclear war while these negotiations proceed. We ask the United States to renounce the first use of nuclear weapons, to say we'll never use them first. We call on the United States to take its weapons off hair trigger alert so that terrorists can't hack into our command and control systems and accidentally cause a nuclear war. We call on the United States to end the situation where the President of the United States has the sole authority to launch nuclear war, meaning that nobody else has to sign off on that decision. And we call on the United States to forego the current plan to spend $1.7 trillion over the next 30 years, enhancing every aspect of our nuclear arsenal, making it more deadly and more usable. And these are, I think, simple common sense steps that will make our country safer and will help to move the process of negotiation with the other nuclear armed states forward.
Yeah, and on one of those points, the U.S., I believe, is unique, is the only acknowledged nuclear state that only requires a single authorization. I believe all of the other nuclear states do have kind of fail-safe plans where it requires, I believe, three authorizations. That tends to be the norm. And I know this issue was raised after the election of Donald Trump, but it became partisan issue and seemingly directed at the person of Donald Trump, as opposed to a broader policy question about, you know, just having, you know, fail-safe mechanisms to ensure the launching of nuclear weapons was more, you know, was.
Yeah. I mean, the obvious instability of Donald Trump and his lack of judgment and his lack of information and knowledge made this issue particularly acute in people's minds. But the problem is more general than the personality of Donald Trump. No human being should ever have the authority to destroy the entire world. No group of people should have that authority either, but certainly no one individual should ever be given that kind of power. So, this is not the answer to the problem, but it's a step in the right direction. The answer is getting rid of the weapons altogether so that nobody could ever use them.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker.
We're discussing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons with Ira Helfand of ICANN. I know that part of the TPNW's campaign has been the way that we've viewed nuclear weapons has largely been kind of a strategic view, you know, having enough second strike capability or deterrence, you know, some sort of political value that's attached to this. And that the TPNW's campaign, and I know ICANN's campaign very much was to shift that attention to the humanitarian disaster that we're risking by the possession of this. Kind of a broad movement on anti-war, you know, anti-militarized sorts of campaigns broadly to focus less on the strategic value of warfare, the strategic value of weapon systems, and instead focus on what level of destruction are we talking about if we ever use those. Is that a fair description of you know, the nature of ICANN's campaign?
Well, absolutely. And I think it was a decision that led to a major breakthrough. Before the current effort to secure this treaty, arms control negotiations were these abstract discussions as though we were playing some kind of chess game. ICANN insisted that, and the nations which were leading these negotiations insisted that the focus needed to be on what would actually happen if the weapons were used, something which the planners don't seem to take into account very often. There are all these elaborate models of the kind of war we'll fight with nuclear weapons. And when you look at the outcome of all of these different scenarios, it's the same. Modern civilization is destroyed and hundreds of millions, or if not billions of people are killed. And if you start the conversation with that outcome, it leads to a very different kind of conversation. Obviously, if that's what's going to happen if the weapons are used, then our primary objective has got to be making sure they're never used. And we know that the only way we can make sure they're never used is to make sure they don't exist. Because as long as they exist, there is the chance that they will be used. What we now know is that a nuclear war between the United States and Russia would very definitely create a nuclear winter that would kill the vast majority of the human race and possibly cause our extinction as a species. But even a much more limited nuclear war that might take place between smaller nuclear armed states in terms of their arsenals, like India and Pakistan, would cause enough climate disruption to trigger a famine that would end modern civilization. And the paper that PSR released in 2013 predicted that a war between India and Pakistan could kill up to 2 billion people across the globe. That's not the extinction of our species, but it is the end of civilization as we know it. And no civilization in history has ever survived disruption of that magnitude. And, you know, if that's the likely outcome, if there's a nuclear war, then obviously preventing that nuclear war has got to be the highest priority of every political leader, no matter what other problems they're dealing with. And it is disturbing and frustrating that the danger of nuclear war has essentially vanished from public discussion. 40 years ago during the 80s, if you ask people what are the major problems facing the world today, preventing nuclear war was number one or number two on everybody's list. If you pose that question today, it doesn't appear on most people's lists. And that is a major part of the problem. We need to figure out how to frighten people again, how to get them to understand what is at stake here. The fact that when they go to bed at night, there's a real chance that they won't wake up in the morning if we don't get rid of these nuclear weapons. And what we have found is that when that conversation takes place, when people are taught the humanitarian impact of nuclear war, what will happen if the weapons are used, it changes their thinking and it makes them want to get rid of these weapons.
So the last question, now that the TPNW has entered into force, there will be meetings of the countries that have ratified the treaty, the meetings of states parties. I know that there's been conversations about the first of those meetings taking place in early 2022. Can you give us some updates as to sort of where that meeting stands and what some of the different plannings are for the, you know, for the first meetings of the states parties?
It is expected that the first meeting of states parties will take place in Vienna, and the hope is that it will be in January of 2022, if COVID permits. I think there's a strong desire that this be an in-person meeting, not a virtual meeting, And so it will depend on whether people are able to travel freely by that time. Hopefully they will be able to, and that's where the meeting will take place. And this will be a gathering of the countries which have signed and ratified the treaty. That's currently 54 have ratified at this point. We expect the number to be significantly higher before the first meeting. And it will be essentially a chance for those countries to gather and plan how they're going to continue to put pressure on the states that haven't signed the treaty yet and haven't gotten rid of their arsenals. It's potentially a very important point in this whole process because it will tend to focus people's attention on the danger of nuclear war. And I should mention that if people are interested in taking action directly here in the United States, I would encourage them to visit the website for the Back from the Brink campaign, which is www.preventnuclearwar.org, one word, preventnuclearwar.org. And there are all kinds of resources on the website and information on how you can become part of this campaign and help to move the United States towards a more responsible nuclear policy and one which actually protects the security and health and lives of the American people.
And we will post that link directly on our show page to make it very easy for you to find that if you'd like to become active and I'd like to participate in this Back to the Brink campaign and to build support for the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. We've been discussing the TPNW, its entry into force in January of this year, 2021, and future steps towards building greater support in the implementation of the treaty itself with our guest, Ira Helfand. He is the co-chair of the Physician for Social Responsibility's Nuclear Weapons Abolition Committee, a member of the ICANN's International Steering Committee, and the co-author of PSR's report, Nuclear Famine, 2 Billion at Risk. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.